from west to east and kingdom to kingdom, you're listening to the Diz Unplugged Connecting with Walt podcast. Connecting with Walt is brought to you by Dreams Unlimited Travel, experts at helping you plan the perfect Disney vacation. Visit them on the web at dreamsunlimitedtravel.com. Hello from the Diz 20th Anniversary Mega Meet at Walt Disney World. I am your host and Diz historian, Michael Bowling, and I am joined by my good friend, co-host, and producer, Craig Williams. Craig, how are you doing on this celebratory week?
I'm doing absolutely great, Michael. It's actually the day we are recording this and releasing it. It is the official 20th anniversary of the Diz, so obviously couldn't be much more excited. The big party at Epcot tonight with 3 hours of attractions, Jodie Benson, and you know, probably a few other surprises here and there. So
illuminations.
Yeah, illuminations.
Or no showing of illuminations.
Yeah.
Food.
I mean, I, along with everyone else, I'm just waiting to find out if we hit our goal of raising $60,000 with this event. Because if we hit that 60,000 mark, then that will push us over $500,000 raised by the Diz and all the supporters, all our supporters out there for Give Kids the World, which that means we're halfway to the goal of 1 million.
That's amazing. That is really amazing. And that's thanks to all the listeners.
Yeah, no,
out
it's
there. I mean, remarkable.
Yeah, you know, we helped to set it up. Many people have helped with regional meets throughout the years too, just to make a big difference. But we couldn't do any of this without you, and that's been part of the greatest thing this week is just getting to see all of our listeners come out here, and you know, not even people who are listeners, just fans of the Diz in general who have made their way out here for the event to see what's happening this week, to donate items to our auction, which will already be closed by the time this is released. So I'm sorry if you didn't get in on that, but it's just been a fantastic week between the little meets we've been doing. We had a Connecting with Walt meetup at the Magic Kingdom.
We did. We had a great time. We met up with, I don't know how many, we didn't take a group photo.
Yeah.
I won't tell you what Carol said to me when I mentioned that to her.
We also, because I announced it on a Disney World Edition show that we would be doing it, and I said what time we'd be doing it and where we would be doing it, but I never said where we should meet up. So we had to play a little catch up on where everyone could find us. But, you know, we ended up having a nice little group, and we just bounced around from some of those classic Walt Disney World attractions that are no longer available at Disneyland.
Yeah, we went, we went to the Tiki Room.
Yep.
And what is nice is that, you know, they're slightly different. There's variations on what's at Disneyland and what's out here at the Magic Kingdom, which is true for most of the attractions, which makes going to both parks really special. We went over then the Country Bear Jamboree.
Yes.
A very missed attraction over at Disneyland. We still have the bears walking around the park, but we don't have their attraction anymore. And then we went over on the People Mover.
Yep.
And saw what's left of Walt's model of what's supposed to be sitting here, Epcot, the city. And then we finally went on Carousel of Progress. So we had a great time. It was just nice meeting all the listeners and sharing some stories about all of the attractions and just chatting.
Oh, yeah. No, I think the highlight ended up actually being Country Bear Jamboree, just because, you know, no one was really against going into it, but a lot of people hadn't done it in a while or weren't really fans before. And I think we finally helped show a lot of people the way of the greatness that is the Country Bear Jamboree.
Yeah. Well, wasn't one of the listeners was Sarah? She'd never been on it.
Yeah.
One of the people, that was her first time.
I know. That was insane.
Yeah.
And she loved it. And she said she couldn't wait to bring her kids on it too. Yeah. So, everyone out there, if you haven't given it a shot in a while, give it another chance. It is so funny. It's such a great show.
It is. It is. Even if it's a little shorter
Yeah.
than the original, it's still a fun show.
Exactly.
Yeah.
everyone just cracks up when Big Al comes on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we're just so happy that we got to meet so many people. We have the big party tonight where we'll meet a lot of people. Of course, I'm also on our Disneyland show, and we had a meetup.
Yeah.
We were at One Man's Dream over at Disney Hollywood Studios. So, again, we had a really nice group, and we walked through One Man's Dream. I shared some stories about some of the displays that are there. And then we saw the... unfortunately, we didn't get to see the film One Man's Dream, but we did get to see the preview for Cars 3. And as I said, it's not Cars 2. It's no Cars 2.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good way to put it. So hopefully... I don't think there's any other big movies coming for a while after Cars 3 in the Disney realm, so maybe we'll get One Man's Dream back for just a little bit.
Yeah, and I got arrested by stormtroopers at the very end. So if you go on my Facebook page, there's a couple of videos that listeners took of my arrest and eventual release.
Good. Yeah, I mean, how else would you be here right now?
it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. No, absolutely it has.
Yeah. Well, you might notice, hey, it's not July, and it's not Friday. So, yeah, Craig and I are, we're doing this when we get together. We always like to record live together in the same room. And we thought we would do a bonus edition for you, our faithful listeners. And Craig and I have frequently talked about some of our favorite Disney animated and live action films, and that's why we're always excited when Turner Classic Movies announces its seasonal Treasures from the Disney Vault schedule. So in the early years of the Disney Channel, and I don't know if you remember those very early years, Craig, the films and shorts from the Disney Vault were broadcast regularly, and that's when the Disney Channel was so good.
I remember Walt Disney. I remember staying up late for it to come on, and the little TV logo with it. I remember all of that. Yeah. So that's how I was introduced to Mickey Mouse Club, Zorro, a lot of those classics. Even just episodes of, whether it was Walt Disney Presents or The Wonderful World of Color, just whatever they were showing on there. Mm-hmm. So that was... Disney Channel was always a staple in my house, even back in the days when you had to pay for it.
Right. So. Oh, the minute it went on the air, I subscribed to it.
Yeah.
So, and, well, of course, now they're broadcast on Turner Classic Movie Channel. And, Craig, can you tell us more about the relationship between the Walt Disney Company and Turner Classic Movies?
Yeah, so back in the ripe old year, I believe, of 2014, it was announced that Turner Classic Movies and the Walt Disney Company would be coming together in a joint partnership for two reasons. The first reason was the Great Movie Ride would be getting a complete upgrade. Not a complete upgrade in terms of animatronics and the new show scenes, the stuff that we, deep down fans of the Great Movie Ride really, really want. But we got a new upgrade to the pre-show area specifically. So instead of showing the trailers from all of the clips or showing trailers from all of the scenes that you go through in the Great Movie Ride, it became more of a long piece of looking at different genres of movies that some of the scenes in the ride end up being in that section. And it's all hosted by Robert Osborne, of course, who is no longer with us. He passed away very recently. I don't find it a little morbid that he's still in there hosting it. It'll look at, romance, and then of course it might go through sci-fi and show off scenes from Alien or the classic musicals, and of course showing scenes from Wizard of Oz, and there's extended clips in there too. It's a really awesome pre-show. It is so much better than just watching the old trailers from some of those movies in there before. I really love what they've done with it. And they couldn't do it without that partnership. They did a little other cute things with some of the displays throughout the queue. So that was on the theme park side of it. But then they also had the broadcast side of it. And that was that Disney would be opening up their vault two Turner Classic Movies to do special broadcasts every couple months. They would be event broadcasts during certain points of the year. So it's basically been right around Christmas time, and then usually in March, then sometime in the June to July time frame, and then again in the fall. And during these nights, the first one was originally hosted by Robert Osborne and one of the other TCM guys, but now Leonard Maltin, who is potentially the biggest Disney fan out there. Mm-hmm. He's just filled with a wealth of knowledge. Of course, we've talked about the old Walt Disney Treasures DVD box sets before, and he did introductions and history pieces on all of those. And so now he's hosting it. And I'm assuming he's making some of the choices for it, but they will just pull out some of the most classic and memorable films from the library of all the Walt Disney features, including restored animated shorts, the classics like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, So Dear to My Heart, but then also they'll go really deep, and they'll pull out some of they'll pull out some of the stuff that was maybe even shot like in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and just aired on TV, like forgotten movies like Mr. Boogity, which isn't super forgotten. Yeah. Halloween fans still always love it, but Treasure of Matacumbe, mm-hmm. which was filmed, the ending was filmed at Walt Disney World. So they'll pull out stuff that you probably have never heard of, and then even and throw in some episodes of The Wonderful World of Color, Walt Disney Presents, Disneyland, all of those episodes. And, you know, it's a great little block. It's always done around themes. And so, like, the first one was very Christmas-oriented. Then they had one that was for one for St. Patrick's Day, where, of course, they had to show Darby O'Gill and the Little People, along with I captured the King of the Leprechauns. Not I killed. That would be very dark. but they do it like that, and every single time there is an outlying theme, including this one that we're going to talk about, which is very summer themed and horse themed. But mm-hmm. It's really great. Like I said, four times a year. This is what I live for since the very first one. There is some sort of magic about watching these movies at home on your television again. And there's also a very active Twitter community that loves when they do these broadcasts. And if you're not a fan of TCM in general, they always have what they call TCM parties, which you use that hashtag, and everyone just kind of will talk about the movies as they're going along and really communicate. People do this with Treasures from the Disney Vault, and it's a fun time. And you know, it starts at 8 o'clock and runs all the way till about 6 a.m. So you know, you have late nights, but it's totally worth it. It is an event.
And that's why in this bonus episode of Connecting with Walt, Craig and I are going to share some information about the June 2nd, 2017 treasures from the Disney Vault films and shorts, in the hope that it will increase your enjoyment and appreciation of these films. Now, we're not going to critique these films in this episode. We may do that in a later episode after you've had a chance to watch them. So there's not going to be, like, spoiler alerts, like, you know, somebody falls off a cliff and dies.
Exactly.
You know. Craig, did you want to run through the schedule so folks know what they're going to be able to see on June 2nd?
Yeah, so, of course, June 2nd, depending on when you're listening to this, it could be tomorrow night, it could be tonight, it could be a couple months back ago, but at 8 o'clock p.m., you'll have Summer Magic from 1963. At 10 o'clock, Pollyanna from 1960. At 12:30 a.m., moving into June 3rd, we have Mickey's Polo Team, one of the great shorts from 1936. At 12:45, you will have The Horse with the Flying Tail from 1960. 1:45, you can expect The Tattooed Police Horse from 1964. 2:45 will show Hacksaw from 1971, and then wrapping up the night at 4:30 a.m. will be The Horse Without a Head from 1963. So a lot that I just have never seen. So I've seen, actually, I believe only two of them. I thought I saw Summer Magic, but then I was reading more about it. I'm like, I may have watched this as a kid, but I don't really remember it. But I know I've seen Pollyanna and Mickey's Polo Team, but the rest one, the horse section, I'm completely flying blind on all those.
Well, what we're going to do is we're going to begin our summer romp through these films in the order that they've aired. So as Craig said, the evening begins at 8 p.m. with Summer Magic. And this stars Haley Mills as Nancy Carey, Burl Ives as Osh Popham, Dorothy McGuire as Margaret Carey, Eddie Hodges as Gilly Carey, Deborah Wally as Cousin Julia, and Jimmy Mathers as the Peter Carey. And yes, he is the little brother of Jerry Mathers, best known as Beaver Cleaver. And a lot of these are names that you'll be familiar with if you watch a lot of Disney live-action films, because people like Haley Mills, Dorothy McGuire, and even Burl Ives, they were staples.
Oh yeah,
for Disney. Burl Ives did a number of Disney albums.
Yeah, you've seen him in So Dear to My Heart, mm-hmm. and if you haven't seen him in that, and you still don't know who he is, go watch Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Yes,
and then you'll understand.
Yes, you'll definitely say, "Oh, that's him." This film was directed by James Nielsen, and the associate producer is Ron Miller, who, of course, is the wife of the late Diane Disney Miller, yep. Walt's oldest daughter. The screenplay for this musical was written by author Sally Benson, and it is based on the book Mother Carey's Chickens by Kate Douglas Wiggins. Now, what's interesting is Sally Benson's stories inspired the 1944 film Meet Me in St. Louis, which is one of my favorites.
I didn't know that. No, it's one of my favorites, too. Of course, you know, you have to watch it at Christmas time every year just so you get Judy Garland singing... Mm-hmm. Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas.
Yeah, but there's a lot of songs that when you watch this film and you hear those songs, you think, oh, it came from that film, because you'll know them. But you'll have no idea they came from that film. Now, Summer Magic tells the story of a destitute Boston widow and her three children. And through the machinations of her daughter Nancy, who's played by Haley Mills, the family moves to a magnificent Victorian mansion in the idyllic small town of Beulah in rural Maine. Now, Sally Benson originally wrote this script as a drama, and Walt, in his wisdom, took the script to his songwriters, Richard and Robert Sherman, and Richard Sherman retold that story. He said, Walt decided he wanted to have a picture with songs. So he gave us Sally Benson's script, and he said, look, I'm thinking of Burl Ives for this picture, and right away we said, boy, does he sing! And Walt was thinking Ives would be Osh Popham, because as an actor, he's wonderful. But we knew him as a folk singer. He just has this wonderful, mellow, rich voice. So we were thrilled, and Walt thought we might be able to find a song for Burl to do. Now, the Sherman brothers proposed many songs for the film in several styles, from ragtime to ballads. And Walt then agreed to make the film a semi-musical and included seven songs. Now, the film was shot almost exclusively at the Walt Disney Studio in Burbank, and some scenes at the Golden Oak Ranch, which is the Disney's film ranch. The exterior of the house was built on one of the studio berms, and most of the backgrounds were created by matte artists. Now, Summer Magic was the Sherman Brothers' first experience bringing a musical to the screen. And at the same time they were working on the development of another film for Walt. You might know it. It's called Mary Poppins. And this film was released on July 7th, 1963. It earned $4 million at the box office, and its running time is 100 minutes.
I'm very excited for this one. You know, I do love Haley Mills. whether we're talking Haley Mills in the next movie we're going to be discussing, or The Parent Trap, or all the way up to the point that she was on Saved by the Bell for us 80s, 90s kids.
But Miss Bliss of something.
Yes. Yep.
Something Miss Bliss. I forget what it is.
Yeah, the original title of it. But no, I'm really excited because I do know the songs from this movie. I know Ugly Bug Ball. That's one of the bigger ones if you're a fan of Disney music. And On the Front Porch, too, as well. Beautiful Beulah. I know that from Disney Parks, hearing it in there. And so it's a lot of this movie is very iconic. And it's definitely, I'm glad that they're leading off with this one. It feels like the perfect way to kind of kick us off into summer.
Yes. This is one that I like to watch every summer.
Oh, yeah?
Because it's a nice summer film. It runs into the fall, so it's sort of nice. And when we do our review show, I'll also talk about its presence in the parks, especially here at the Magic Kingdom and Walt Disney World. It has a presence.
I know the Osh Pop'em. We learned that on our last tour of Main Street that we took last year for connecting with Walt.
Right, at the 10th anniversary of the Diz Unplugged podcast. Yeah. But there's another shop, actually. Oh. And of course, there are three songs that were part of the Main Street background music. Main Street USA background music before it was redone.
Yes.
So so a lot of people think that music was some sort of Victorian ragtime, you know, authentic, but it was actually from Summer Magic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, after you've had a break to make more popcorn and get some malted milk balls, the next feature is Pollyanna at 10 p.m., also starring Haley Mills as the title character. Again, a number of really big names at the time acted in this film. Jane Wyman was Aunt Polly. You might know her as the first wife of President Ronald Reagan. Richard Egan as Dr. Edmund Chilton. Fans of The Nanny and the Professor will especially know him. Carl Malden is Reverend Paul Ford. Streets of San Francisco fans, there you go. Nancy Olson is Nancy Furman. She went on to perform in several Disney films. Agnes Moorehead as Mrs. Snow. Of course, she was in Bewitched. And so, anyway, and Adolph Menju is Mr. Pendergrass, again, a great character actor. This was his last film. Kevin Corcoran as Jimmy Bean. You might know him as Moochie.
Yeah.
As in his, he was in many Disney films. And Retta Shaw as Tilly Lagerlöf. Of course, she was and went on to be one of the maids in Mary Poppins. Yeah. So quite a stable of actors in this film.
Oh, yeah. No, this is... And it is the actors that truly do end up making this movie. And that's why when you talk about movies like 20,000 Leagues, Swiss Family Robinson, Old Yeller, Pollyanna should be one of the ones you're discussing in that, too, because it could be a top five Disney live action movie overall. So I know I watched it many times growing up. This was a favorite of my mom's. So
that's a good film. David Swift wrote the screenplay and directed the film, which is based on the novel by Eleanor H. Porter. And this tells the story of a young orphan girl who's forced to live with her aunt, who is a dominating force in the town. And Pollyanna's positive philosophy about life and a sunny attitude proves to be a power stronger than even her aunt, and it transforms the lives of the townsfolk. Now, Pollyanna was David Swift's first film, and he has very fond memories of the production. Walt loved the script and provided Swift with all the studio resources, including a $2.5 million budget. Keep in mind, this is 1960s. That's quite a bit
that's a lot.
Of money.
Yeah.
And told Swift he could hire any actors he wanted. And Swift recalled, Walt had purchased the rights to the Eleanor Porter novel, which was published in 1912, I believe. So he gave me the book and asked me what I thought. And I said I loved it. He said, well, do a treatment. So I went home and wrote a 60-page outline. It was like a condensation of what the picture was going to be. And it may be the best writing I've ever done since. It was just marvelous, and it was pretty much the picture that ended up on the screen, almost shot for shot. Walt loved it. He called me at home and said, "Bud, I finished your story, and I had a little tear." I said, "What you mean is you cried, right?" "Yes, I cried. I loved it. Let's make the movie." "Does that mean it's a go-ahead on a screenplay?" "Yes, what do you think I'm talking about?" what a great interaction that was.
Oh, yeah.
So I wrote the screenplay, and he loved that also, but it was much too long. I said that we had to cut it. He said, "No, I'll tell you when to cut it." Well, then we'd scream and yell at each other. So this was Hayley Mills' second film. She had previously acted in a British film, Tiger Bay, with her actor father, John Mills, who would go on to star in Swiss Family Robinson father. Yeah. Now, both father and daughter were very nervous about Hayley going solo. Jane Wyman said, "The funny thing about Hayley is that she doesn't consciously try to steal scenes from other actors. She just can't help it." By all reports, this was an idyllic set. According to Swift, everyone was cooperative, happy, and punctual. Carl Malden was so dedicated to his role, he reported early for the film and spent almost 3 weeks rehearsing his part unpaid. Now, the film's exteriors were shot on the Disney Studios backlot, the Warner Brothers Studios backlot, and on location in Santa Rosa and the Napa Valley in Northern California. Many of the Victorian homes and railroad station in the film were filmed in the Santa Rosa area. So was the swimming hole seen in the beginning of the credits, which had to be refilled by the local fire department because it had run dry. Now, the house of Jane Wyman, who plays Aunt Polly, was the Santa Rosa home of Mrs. Juilliard MacDonald. And it was built in 1877, and it is a replica of the MacDonald's Natchez, Mississippi home built before the Civil War. And the real house is actually one story smaller than it appears in the film. So to make the house appear more imposing, as you'll see the character of Aunt Polly is, a matte artist Peter Ellenshaw added the extra story. Now, the sets for Pollyanna were dressed by Academy Award-winning set director Emile Curie, whom we've talked about previously for his work on the parks, and his son. Costumes were created by Academy Award-winning designer Walter Plunkett, who designed the costumes for both Gone with the Wind and An American in Paris. So even the behind-the-scenes production, you know, big names were hired to put this film together. Now, the film also required 150 human extras, 30 sheep, 18 horses, and 6 crates of live chickens. Now, fans of the film can still visit many of the locations used in this film. The MacDonald Mansion still stands in Santa Rosa, but if you do decide to go on a visit to see Disney sites in Northern California, it is a private residence, so don't disturb the occupants. You know, just admire the home from outside. The mill that Kevin Corcoran runs past in the film's opening credits is the Bale Grist Mill in St. Helena, and the train station is also in St. Helena. The town sets are still on the Warner Brothers backlot and are part of the Warner Brothers studio tour. And the set is known as Midwest Street. And if it looks familiar to you when you watch this film, it's because it's been used in many films, including The Music Man.
Yep.
It seems appropriate. Now, I don't know if you knew this, Craig, but you know, I'm sure Alfred Hitchcock liked to make cameo appearances in his films.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but David Swift liked to do the same. So look for him as the fireman who scolds Kevin Corcoran during the orphanage fire sequence. Oh, and David Swift's career was a screenplay itself. He started out at the Disney Studios as an office boy.
I did not know either of those.
Yeah, and he worked his way up. So now, Pollyanna was released on May 19th, 1960. Its running time is 134 minutes. It's one of the longest Disney films. Pollyanna's box office gross of $3,750,000 did fall short of the $6 million goal. And Walt Disney thought he knew the reason. I think the picture would have done better with a different title. Girls and women went to it, but men tended to stay away because it sounded sweet and sticky.
And I absolutely agree. It's still the same battle that Disney is fighting with today on, not using the Snow Queen, making it Frozen, not using Rapunzel, changing the name to Tangled. This is the exact same way. This isn't a movie exclusively for women and children. This is a very, very good movie overall. And like I've already said, it's one of the best Disney live action movies. And I hope this opens it up to a brand new audience that might not have caught it on DVD or any other home release throughout the 90s and 2000s. And you know, since Blu-ray, it hasn't been released, so this is a nice way to start getting it back out there.
Yeah, I think folks will enjoy this film. Now, you will need this next intermission to toss out all your used tissue, because you may be teary-eyed at the end of Pollyanna, and head to the washroom and make some nachos for the upcoming animated short at 12:30 a.m. Mickey's Polo Team, which was released on June 4th, 1936, and directed by David Hand. This Mickey Mouse short reflects Walt Disney's love of the game of polo. And Mickey's Polo Team of cartoon stars, Donald Duck, Goofy, and the Big Bad Wolf, takes on a team of Hollywood stars that includes Laurel and Hardy, Harpo Marx, and Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah, and of course, all four of those names, if you don't recognize Laurel and Hardy, Harpo Marx, or Charlie Chaplin, these are all basically the biggest of the silent film comedies era. So, you know, you might know the Marx brothers, not just Harpo, but these were the famous comedians of the day. These are the biggest ones. It would, you know, it would be like the equivalent of, I don't even know who's considered to be that famous to these days, like, putting Jim Carrey and
maybe Robin Williams.
If Robin Williams was still alive, putting Jim Carrey, Robin Williams, and a couple other of the bigger names all in a room together and saying, like, okay, these are going to be the all-star teams. Mm-hmm. So huge, huge names.
Yeah. Now there's a lot of caricatures in here. This was like Walt's second Hollywood oriented short film where there were a lot of he did caricatures of the big stars at the time.
Yeah.
So the characters you're going to see, the referee is Jack Holt. I'm not familiar with who Jack Holt is.
Neither am I.
But he looks very burly in the film. The Mickey Mousers team is Mickey Mouse, Goofy as the Goof, Big Bad Wolf, Donald Duck, he rides a donkey in this for some reason.
Of course.
The movie stars team includes Stan Laurel, Oliver Hardy, as we talked about, Harpo Marx, he's riding an ostrich, Charlie Chaplin is on the team. Yep. And now there's a lot of spectators in here, so you want to keep an eye out for them. See how many you recognize. Shirley Temple, and she's seated with the three little pigs.
Yeah, and you know, she should be easy to pick out. If you've been living under a rock for the last 100 years, then maybe you don't know who Shirley Temple is, but I think everyone knows who Shirley Temple is.
She gave Walt the special Oscar for Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs at the Academy Awards. Yeah. So you see her in that photo. That's her. Charles Laughton, he is an actor, of course, who's dressed as Henry VIII. Mm-hmm. And which he had starred in a film, Henry VIII, at the time that was very, very popular. Eddie Cantor, who was a very popular singer and actor of the era. W.C. Fields, so again, a great comedian, made his running shtick was that he was always drunk and hated children. Harold Lloyd, we already mentioned.
Yeah, he's another one of the silent film stars that he's also on the same level as Chaplin, Marx Brothers, Laurel and Hardy. he's just less recognized because his stuff wasn't as widely available throughout the years in kind of the public domain as the rest of those comedians were.
I think that the Disney short Mickey's Clock Cleaners or something. I think that was a parody of a very famous Harold Lloyd.
Exactly.
Film.
Yes. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Greta Garbo, who was known for her beauty and, let's just say, great dramatic roles. She's in there waving a pom-pom.
Mm-hmm.
Edna Mae Oliver, a very, very well-known character actress. If you see her, you realize, oh gosh, you saw her in a ton of films from the 30s and 40s. She's seated next to Max Hare from the Disney short The Tortoise and the Hare. Clark Gable, he's seated with a star-struck Clarabelle Cow. Pluto is in there. Fifi the Pekingese, who was in a number of the shorts. Two Easter bunnies from The Funny Little Bunnies. The Little Wise Hen from The Wise Little Hen. The Flying Mouse and His Mother from The Flying Mouse. Peter and Polly Penguin from Peculiar Penguins. King Midas and Goldie the Elf from The Golden Touch. Ambrose Puss the Cat and Dirty Bill the Dog Robber from The Robber Kitten. Cock Robin and Jenny Wren from Who Killed Cock Robin. And of course, those characters were also caricatures of big Hollywood stars at the time. Most notably, Jenny Wren was a caricature of Mae West. Will Rogers was also to have been portrayed in this short, but due to his death in a plane crash, his caricature was removed from the film. All of these characters I mentioned, these were all Disney shorts that had been released that were very popular still at that era. So any.
It's a great short. So it's this one's been shown throughout the years, many places. And, you know, usually it is to point out all of the caricatures of these classic film stars, just to remind people that this is one of the things that was happening. These were the famous people of the day. So if you haven't seen this one, you know, you can watch it on YouTube. You can see it many places, but I'm sure this is going to be the way to see it, the best way it looks, because it'll be a restored version of it for sure.
Now, Mickey's Polo Team is the perfect introduction for the 12:45 in the morning presentation of the Walt Disney Productions 1960 documentary, The Horse with the Flying Tail. And this film is about the Palomino Horse Nautical, who won the team gold medal at the 1959 Pan American Games. And this won the Academy Award for Best Documentary at the 33rd Academy Awards. And to tell you a little about who Nautical was, he was born in New Mexico in 1944 and was at one point owned and trained by a Colonel Anderson Norton and his daughter Sue. Otherwise, the horse's history is mostly unknown. He bounced from place to place, home to home, but unlike the movie claims, it doesn't seem as if he had been abused. Nautical was officially registered as Peter De Oro, but was originally shown as Injun Joe. Hugh Wiley became a member of the United States Aquarian Team, or USET, in 1950 as an alternate for the international shows held in the United States. And then, ironically, in his first international-level competition, he competed as a temporary member of Ireland's team. Apparently, some members of Ireland's team were injured, and they didn't have enough riders to compete. So the United States offered to loan a rider to Ireland and drew names to decide who competed. And Hugh was one of the Americans competing, and Ireland ended up winning the competitions that year. In 1955, Hugh gets a phone call from the executive vice president of USET asking if he could compete with the team in Europe in a month. Hugh says yes and was told he'd need two horses to compete. At the time, he had one horse who was barely good enough to compete, though he didn't share that with the USET vice president. Hugh calls a friend for help finding a horse and is told to check out Nautical, still known as Injun Joe. Hugh had actually seen Nautical before, but thought he seemed like a difficult horse. And Nautical had won some shows, but not consistently. So Hugh went to see Nautical again at a show in Pennsylvania, but wasn't considering buying him. So after watching the horse in one class, he knew he had to get him. His jumps were unbelievable. He was described as a crowd pleaser, fun to watch, but tough to ride. In a few days, Nautical had a new home. At first, Hugh thought Nautical was completely nuts. He'd been told Nautical thrived on work, but when he worked him, the horse exploded if he saw a jump. On the ground, though, Nautical was gentle. Hugh had two horses and headed to New Jersey to meet up with the coach, Bernie DeNemethy, and the team at a farm owned by Arthur McCation. They arrived in New Jersey, and Hugh thought Nautical would be the worst horse on the team. Once the coach wanted to watch the horses jump a water jump and a bank jump, Nautical refused both, until McCation stood behind him with a whip. And then he jumped so high, Hugh thought they'd never land. Though everything else that day did not go well, DeNemethy thought Nautical had potential. So over several months, all Nautical did was flat work. He became easier to handle, but was still unpredictable. He'd take off at a jump, ignoring the rider. So whilst training for the 1956 Olympics, Nautical developed a sand crack on his left front hoof, and the vet had to cut off most of the hoof so it'd heal. DeNemethy worked with Nautical once his hoof grew back enough, and things are working out. Nautical was finally settling down. Nautical officially retired in 1960, though the official ceremony was held in 1961 at the National Horse Show. He was 17 when he officially retired. He competed some in late 1960, but when he fell, landing from a big jump, the decision was made to retire him. He passed away 6 years later. His retirement was spent just being a horse. He lived in the USET Training Center in New Jersey, then moved back to Hugh's farm in Maryland. He was around 23 when he passed away. So the horse with the flying tail was released on December 21st, 1960. Its running time is 48 minutes.
The story sounds fascinating and interesting. We'll see how it plays out in documentary form, though. You know, usually when you get to this point in time, it's starting to get late. After two long movies and a short, this might be one that you start to nod off during, but that's why you have to use a DVR for this. You have to be able to go back and watch them if you can't make it through. So, but, you know, Disney was great at making documentaries, so I'm sure this one's going to hold up just like the rest of them.
It won the Academy Award, but now you have the real story of Nautical, so then we can see in the documentary how
dramatized it all. Yeah.
Now the equestrian theme continues at 1:45 with the 1964 Disney featurette, The Tattooed Police Horse. And this tells the story of Jolly Roger, a well-bred trotter who likes to gallop. He and another horse, Tartan, are raised together. Now Tartan learns easily and runs to win. Roger is a bit nervous and has a troubling habit of breaking into a gallop when startled by noises, crowds, or any other distraction. This habit disqualifies him from winning any trotting race. So he is championed by Pam Churchill, who owns and works him out, but after too many disqualifications, Roger is sold to his trainer, and Roger is soon running at county fairs and eventually sold at auction. So a Boston police captain with a good eye for horses purchases Roger and is able to work with him. All of the sounds of the city rattle the skittish Roger, but under the steadying hand of the captain, Roger soon becomes a top police horse. On duty at a special trotting race, Roger's blood is stirred by the sights and sounds of the track, and when an accident occurs, he doesn't gallop, but trots to the rescue at full throttle with a surprised captain on his back. Roger is soon reunited with Pam Churchill, who identifies Roger as a racehorse by the tattoo inside his upper lip. And Pam realizes Roger is matured and ready to race. Now, the Tattooed Police Horse was released on December 18th, 1964. Its running time is 48 minutes.
I'm excited for this one. I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So it just it sounds like it's got that goofy classic Disney comedy side to it, but obviously there's going to be a little heart to it as well.
Oh yeah.
So I'm very excited for it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this one as well. So now at 2:45 a.m., we move from theatrical releases to the 1971 telefilm Hacksaw. And this was originally broadcast on NBC as a two-part episode on The Wonderful World of Disney on September 26th and October 3rd, 1971. And a telefilm was directed by Larry Landsberg and stars Tab Hunter as Tim Andrews and Victor Milan as Cascade Joe. Again, two very well-known actors in the day. And basically, a girl goes on vacation to the mountains where she finds a wild horse named Hacksaw. With a little help from a modern cowboy, she captures the horse, and it doesn't take long until the man who helped her trains the horse to pull a harness. Now, since Hacksaw refuses to have anyone on his back, he then enters the horse in the Calgary Stampede Chuck Wagon Race.
Yeah, I don't know about this one either. This might be one that is better left in the vault. So some of these 70s Disney films that were made are very, very rough. Definitely the growing pains of learning how to do things after Walt's passed away. I'm gonna stick through it. I'm gonna watch it all, but I don't know if I'm looking forward to this one.
Yeah. I don't know anything about this, but we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll
see. Yeah.
Yeah. And now you can start thinking about what to have for breakfast as the sun begins to peek over the horizon. Then welcome the brand new day at 4:30 a.m. with the telefilm, The Horse Without a Head. This was filmed on location in Paris and stars Jean-Pierre Amont as Police Inspector Sene, who, when a kindly junk dealer takes a group of poor French children, he gives them a headless toy horse. And the children name themselves the Knights of the Headless Horse. And this broken toy becomes their only source of fun. And the inspector's well-ordered existence is turned upside down by the children, who delight in racing their headless toy horse up and down the streets of Paris. Now, villainous Herbert Lom, might know him from the Pink Panther series, he decides to take advantage of the children's innocence by hiding a key in the headless horse. This is a key to a deserted factory where he has hidden 10 million francs stolen from a safe deposit box in a Dijon bank. Now, this was released theatrically in Europe, and A Horse Without a Head was originally telecast in two parts on September 29th, 1963, and October 6th, 1963, as the third season opener of Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color.
Yeah, this is another one I think it's going to be a lot better than it sounds on paper. I think it's going to... This is going to be a good one to stick through. Usually the final ones they show of the night are, they have a little bit of humor to them. They might not be as well known, but there's usually something there worth value to get you through all the way to the final finish line on that. So I am looking forward to this one. I think it'll be a little bumbling and just silly, but it has promise. It has a lot of promise.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this one. I watched a little trailer that's on YouTube, and it looks very well done.
Yeah.
Very well filmed. It looks like they did. You can see on the screen where the money went.
Yeah, those on location films that Walt Disney has done. When they were filming all the time in England and other places throughout the world, they have something about the looks when they go on like location. They nail it. It always looks beautiful.
Now, if you miss any of these films or your DVR is too full to record all of these, many of these are available on home video, Disney Movies Anywhere, and even YouTube. I did use a couple of very good books as references for this bonus episode. Walt Disney and live action, the Disney Studios live action features of the 1950s and 60s by John G. West. And we've already mentioned Leonard Maltin. I used his book, The Disney Films. Mm-hmm. A website where I learned all about nautical, Horse Nation, Horsing Around the World, The Secret History, The Fascinating Story of Nautical, A Palomino Show Jumper with a Golden Career. So Craig, are you going to be staying up watching all these films?
Oh, yeah. No, I always DVR it just in case I can't be home. But if I'm home, I stick through it all as much as I can. Every now and then I'll nod off. But again, that's why I tape them too, so that way I can go back and watch any part that I may have missed. But like I said before, it's an event. It's really a thing where there's a community who is all very excited about watching these movies, watching the shorts. And it's something that if you do watch it later, it's still fun. It's still cool to catch up on these. But as it happens, you know, it's bigger than I think what they expected it to be. And it's very special. And I always tune in because I don't want this to go away. Mm-hmm. And then we lose access to all these great movies, shorts, features. It's just, you know, there's rumors that Disney and TCM may be on the outs with each other.
I was going to ask you about that because there's a rumor they're going to completely redo the great movie ride.
Yeah, there is that rumor. And so I don't know the validity of it, but I'd be upset if that was the case and they don't show these anymore, because TCM is the perfect channel to do that. I wish Disney Channel was, but that's just gone now. It's beyond. Disney does a great job of putting a lot of their classics now on YouTube on demand and other sites where you have to pay for all of these. But so it's great to have them all piled in. That just comes with your cable subscription for those of us who haven't cut the cord yet.
Yes.
So I love it. I will be tuning in. And if you see me on Saturday, I will also be like very out of it.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I'll get to watch them because I'll still be here.
Yeah,
and then I'm flying home the next day. But I'll definitely watch them in various mediums so that we can talk about them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So now we hope this very special bonus episode of Connecting with Walt will enhance your viewing pleasure and appreciation of these Disney films. And if you are at Walt Disney World for the 20th anniversary Mega Meet, please don't be shy about coming up and saying hello.
Yeah.
Because even at our Connecting with Walt Meet, there were people standing on the fringes that didn't come up and say hello. And then they were sort of gone before I had a chance to talk to some of them.
No, this goes for any time of the year. Anytime you see us out there, don't be afraid to say hi. We always appreciate it, meeting people who enjoy what we do, because we're doing it for you.
Absolutely, yeah. If you see me at Disneyland or the Walt Disney Family Museum, I meet people just sometimes walking down the street.
Yeah.
So in my town. But definitely say hello anytime you see us. And thank you for making us a part of your day. And remember, I only hope that we don't lose sight of one thing, that it was all started by a man, Walt Disney, and his brother Roy. And Craig and I look forward to seeing you in July with a new season of Connecting with Walt and at the D23 Expo, almost right next door to Disneyland.